but how did it keep 3,500 people employed there?
Well, there wouldn't be 3,500 at that stage. It would have reduced a fair bit. But recovery was actually about to come in an interesting way. Towards the end of the 50s, well, first, Bolands went into the biscuit business. And, of course, you know, nothing stimulates business like competition. If you have another fella at it too, advertising, or people in those days didn't do that much advertising, but nonetheless, distribution and interest and whatever, it helped the biscuit market to grow. And towards the end of the 50s, I know Edward Bewley probably was the chairman then, but he certainly would have been very conscious of the need for change. Mm-hmm. Something had to, you know, happen. And I haven't got the precise order of events or sequence of events, but essentially I would identify two things that have been quite important. Firstly, in 1958, Gordon Lambert, my predecessor, was appointed. He, like myself, Gordon was chartered accountant. That was his background. That was his. He worked as a finance director. Like myself, perhaps his eventual career took him a long distance away from accountancy. In 1958, he was appointed commercial director with the responsibility of jizzing things up, making things happen, and so on. And he was good at that. And 2-3 years later, this is quite odd really, Irish Television was founded in 1961.
That's right.
You know, the Jacobs Awards is
yes.
Now it's part of history. But it started the first year. I mean, Jacobs said they would sponsor this thing called a television awards programme. But the impact of television on Jacobs is far, far greater than the television awards. Because Gordon Lambert sensed that, presumably seeing what happened in other parts of the world, here was a tremendous opportunity to market biscuits in a modern sense, for the first time ever. Mm-hmm. Now, Jacobs were probably very good at marketing their product over the decades previously, but marketing was a limited concept. You know, it was bore posters or signs in shops and this kind of thing. But Lambert went big into television advertising, and he had a man named Mac Kyle who ran Irish International Advertising.
That's right.
And between the two of them, I mean, they developed characters like Jim Fickerty was the most famous one, but there were many, many others like that. You know, 37 Biscuits to Wexford and Marietta Biscuits and so on. And in the early years of RTE, Jacobs were the biggest single advertiser on Irish television. But a great deal of money by the standards of those times. And the result was biscuit consumption shot up.
Right.
Yeah. And at one stage, I remember in the 60s, I remember Gordon telling me that I think we were the biggest, per capita, the biggest consumers of biscuits in the world.
Isn't that extraordinary, the impact of television and what it did?
From a base whereby biscuits were seen to be a luxury, biscuits became, you know, common an everyday purchase. Biscuits, Jacobs, certainly when I first arrived in 1971, but certainly by the end of the 60s, would have been the largest single supplier to virtually every Irish grocery outlet.
That was a terrific result at that
14,000 customers at that stage. Mm. Now, we had those customers all the years along, of course. And you may remember, I mean, old people will remember, you went into a shop, you had the biscuit tins out in the, and there were glass tins, and you could see in, and you could take your biscuits out and put them in a scoop and put them in a paper bag, what have you.
And all the different varieties. You had the,
Fig rolls. Mariette, ginger nut, Lincoln cream, custard creams.
Huge variety.
Raspberry and custard. Raspberry and custard was a famous biscuit. It won gold medals in various food fairs across the world.
Were they all taught up and manufactured. I know they were manufactured, but were they the concept for each recipe, was it thought up here?
Yeah, it would have been. You see, there are a limited number of things you can do. You've got a limited number, basically flour, sugar, vegetable fats, chocolate, coconut. Now, you can blend and mix and bake and what have you, but there's a limited number of results you're going to get.
True, and I suppose the figs.
The figs.
And
the
of course, you will tell me how they got the figs in
there. the fig was unusual. The
fig was great advertising.
It was fantastic, unbelievable. Yeah, unbelievable. They each biscuit now some ginger was another commodity. We would copy from other people. Other people would copy from us, but yet take a digestive biscuit.
Yeah,
I would say, and it used to pain my older family colleagues, but they would agree. We could never make a digestive as good as McVitie's could.
Mm. Really?
Yes. Whereas they could never make a cream cracker like we could. And so it went.
And the competition was screwed.
Yeah, you know, but individual products were thought up, invented, if that's the word. There was a great explosion, if you like, in the 60s. Yeah. Because Ireland in the 60s was a changing place. Yeah. Consumers were much better off after the dull, dire, poor 50s. People were better off. And then as we came into the 60s as well, another major development in the biscuit business, is not just in Jacobs, was the concept of airtight packages.
Yes.
Only started in the late 50s, believe it or not.
Yes.
And that revolutionised biscuit making. But prior to that, you baked a biscuit, and the biscuits were packed into these boxes.
They were all loose.
That's right. Even when I came in 1971, I think about 25% of the sales were in loose boxes. Now, 20 years earlier, 100% would have been in loose boxes.
Yeah.
So the transition to packets came quite quickly.
Yeah.
But it made life very different for a biscuit maker, because you know, your biscuits are baked on travelling ovens.
Yeah.
They just don't go into your oven like at home. The oven travels. You have to do that because of the sheer volume. I mean, you could have hundreds of thousands of biscuits coming off in a particular oven in a matter of a few hours. So as the oven travels, the band on it travels, say its journey takes 20, 25 minutes, whatever it takes, the biscuit is being baked.
Mm-hmm.
So the dough goes in at one end and the finished biscuit comes out at the other end. And the limiting factor, very often, to the speed of the oven, and i.e. the productivity of the whole operation, would be how quickly can you get the biscuits off the end. The old days, done by hand. Now the biscuits are going to have to go into a packet. And, you know, they have to be packed by a machine. And this now is introducing an element of very, very high-spec engineering that was never there before. Because, say, you know, the packet will have to be a particular length, unchangeable, inflexible length. Therefore, the biscuits will have to be of a certain width or diameter or whatever. You need to be a lot sharper at the baking end, as it happened even by the 70s, certainly into the 80s. The high speed wrapping machines were being developed, mainly in Switzerland.
Yeah.
So we used to buy most of our wrapping machines from a Swiss firm called SIG, S-I-G. They were the Rolls Royce of wrapping machine makers.
Where did the concept come from? The wrappers, you know, the putting the biscuits into...
Would have been developed in the UK. That would have been developed internationally.
And then the idea would have come over here eventually.
No, you see, the whole... Remember, once biscuits went into an airtight wrapper, then they were good for 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 months. Because they were airtight.
So they had longer
shelf life.
And was that idea was just about coming in as
That's right. I mean, it's interesting when Frank Smith started. You've heard of Smith's Crisps, I'm sure.
Yes,
they were the original crisp makers in Britain. Frank Smith started, as I remember it, making crisps sometime probably towards the end of the war in the mid 1940s, and Smith's became huge. Business in Britain. They built a number of factories near seaside resorts because, you see, the crisps are baked and had to be consumed quite quickly.
And that's why they of course,
you see,
yes.
Whereas so later on, when the airtight packet came, you can buy your tato now in the local shop. It may have been made 3 or 4 weeks earlier. It doesn't matter. It's that they're air sealed, they're perfectly fresh, etc. But so, not just crisps, biscuits, all kinds of food products.
Yeah.
Changed their whole shelf life prospect by having them in airtight packets. So it wasn't just biscuits as such.
Yeah.
But big impact. It came for a good time for Jacobs in the 60s into the 70s when things were beginning to go well for us. So in the 1960s, sitting in the boardroom in Jacobs, anywhere else, Ireland was becoming a good place to be. Things were perking up. Mr. Lamass was in charge, and he was talking increasingly about the needing to look out.
Mm-hmm.
And he started in 1965 with the Anglo-Irish Free Trade Agreement.
Yes, of course.
And undoing all the years of tariffs and well, look, we must trade more with Britain and we must import more and export more instead of this concept of we'll do everything ourselves kind of thing. It's interesting doing everything ourselves. I mean, in the 30s and the 40s, even probably the 50s, in a company like Jacobs, for instance, not only did they make biscuits, but they made the tins.
Oh, yes, of course, all the packaging was...
A lot of the packaging they made themselves. They made some of the machinery. They did an awful lot of things in-house.
Yes.
Because maybe there's a certain culture that favoured that, but very often there was nobody outside. There was no local supplier who had the know-how, the technology, or whatever to do that.
Yeah.
And one of the interesting byproducts of that, one of the less satisfactory byproducts, was you had a lot of different trades, as we call it. You had locksmiths, carpenters, plumbers, electricians, sheet metal workers, plasterers, all kinds of people. By 1976, 30% difference. Mm. And we lobbied the government here, I remember. Ian Cosgrove wasn't part of the time. Telling them, look, I mean, the way this thing is going, Jacobs is going to collapse. In fact, we lost money in 1977. Interesting statistic. I think I'm right in saying... 150 years, the only time money year the company ever lost money. One year.
Yes, but there was a whole lot of other things now. You
there were other issues involved.
There were,
but this was fundamental, this cap, this difference in agricultural prices. And the government, in fact, took on board, Mark Clinton was the Minister of Agriculture at the time, went to Brussels. I spent a lot of time in Brussels myself then, one of my colleagues, Ben Parr, and the government negotiated a deal whereby, it's an interesting thing, this was community-wide now, whereby when products like biscuits containing flour move from one market to another, a levy was imposed to equalise the purchasing of the flour, the sugar, whatever it happened to be. What do they call them? MCAs, monetary compensatory amounts.
Well, that's where we come to the end of part one in this two-part interview with Leo O'Donnell.